Okay, Ian Trottier here for Discussions of Truth. And today, joining the show, who I'll be phoning in here momentarily, Jonathan Marshall, author of Dark Quadrant. He's standing by, and he's been standing by here for a few moments. Bring him in on Skype right now, Jonathan Marshall, author of Dark Quadrant. That number, right? Should be. Okay. Yeah, that's it. Okay.
Hello?
Jonathan, Ian Trottier here.
Oh, hi. I almost gave up on you.
Okay, well, I'm glad you didn't. I apologize for the tardiness here. Had a little difficulty getting things squared away at the studio, but I do appreciate you you waiting and being versatile. Welcome to Discussions of Truth, sir, and it's a pleasure to connect with you. Would you, for listeners, please introduce yourself, and we'll get into Dark Quadrant. Give listeners a moment to introduce yourself here, who you are and what you do.
Sure. Thank you, Ian. I am a retired journalist. I worked for a national political magazine. I worked for several newspapers, including economics editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. I've also published 6 books, mostly on international affairs, modern history. I published numerous scholarly articles along with several thousand journalistic articles. And my latest work, which of course is the subject of this conversation, it grows out of years of study. It's called Dark Quadrant, Organized Crime, Big Business, and the Corruption of American Democracy from Truman to Trump. So it focuses on post-World War II history, political history, and the intersection with crime and other powerful forces.
Fascinating. And we've seen a lot happen since World War II, and certainly one of them being the abolishment under Richard Nixon of the gold standard in 1971 and the Nixon shock. Jonathan, what is this is yeah, this is a pretty heavy subject. And there really aren't a whole lot of people that are willing to even have the patience to start to look into this type of economic corruption that plagues the nation. Why is it that you got into it? What was it that kind of caught your eye or your attention that there was something going on that got you looking into this?
There were a couple things. I got interested actually in my late high school and then into early college years in some aspects of recent history that affected our involvement in the Vietnam War, which was at that time, I'm a bit a certain age, so I was coming of age in the Vietnam War and wondered why we were involved so far away in this very long and costly war. And it became apparent that one of the reasons was a fear of successive U.S. presidents of losing Vietnam to communism the way Truman was said to have lost China to the communists. It had a really indelible impact on our nation's politics. And recently revealed memos from Lyndon Johnson indicate that he knew from the very beginning that the war was lost, but he couldn't afford politically to be seen as the one who lost it. So he needed to keep it going. So as I researched this, I discovered that there was a great deal of corruption that lay behind the so-called China Lobby, this group of people who were battering the Truman administration for its alleged softness on communism. It was sort of unclear what we were supposed to do about it. Were we really supposed to dispatch our divisions to mainland China and fight the Red Chinese there? But he paid a very heavy price for that. And as I say, there was a surprising amount of corruption in the form of actual payoffs to American politicians that U.S. aid would go to the nationalist Chinese, the anti-communist Chinese, who would in turn reroute some of that aid in the form of political contributions and even sub rosa under the table money. And later I discovered that even the China lobby was being funded by the narcotics traffic. And one of the people I discovered who was most knowledgeable about all of this was a professor at UC Berkeley, which was near to where I went to school at Stanford, Peter Dale Scott.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever had him on your show, but
not yet.
He was a great influence, and we went on to write two books together, one on the Iran-Contra affair, another on called Cocaine Politics, about drugs, armies, and the CIA in Central America in the mid-1980s. So he got me really intensely interested in this very underreported intersection of crime and politics, which historians have largely ignored, which journalists have certainly been interested in, but only in their kind of ephemeral, quick reporting style, never with the kind of systematic attention that Peter has given it, and then I, hopefully in this book as well, have given the topic.
I've known of Peter's work for a couple of years, and I do believe I've reached out to him. I'm not sure if I've gotten a response or not, but he has done some incredible work. Being a Stanford alum yourself, let me ask you a question here. Are you familiar with a former Hoover Institute fellow named Anthony Sutton?
Actually, I am. I don't think I ever got to know him personally, but I certainly, many years ago, read some of his books sort of on the Bolshevik Revolution and related matters. And Hoover, I might add, was my first job at Stanford was being a library page at Hoover. So I got inside access to all the books there. And one of the books that I used actually on a key early paper on the China lobby was a book that Hoover has one of the only copies in the world of. It was a book that was published in 1960 by Macmillan and then withdrawn from circulation before it could be distributed because it was threatened by members of the China lobby with lawsuits. And so the one or two review copies went out and Hoover got one. So I was able to get access to it. But it's certainly an institution that's had riches of resources and certainly cultivated a lot of interesting scholars, of which Sutton is one.
I began the show in 2016. I began the research that led up to the show. The official show was January 2017. But I began this because a friend of mine had me look into the Zika virus and the controversy around the pesticide local to Miami Beach at the time. And I was quickly led to this Anthony Sutton that has written extensively about the corruption inside the Federal Reserve, and as you're saying, the Bolshevik Revolution, and also some of these societies that would certainly most likely allude to organized crime syndicates and that nature. So Anthony Sutton serves as one of those benchmark scholars, if you will, from whence I basically began my show. Let's get into a little bit of this China lobby, however, if you would, Jonathan. Describe for listeners, what is this China lobby? In 1945 is when the Chinese Central Bank post World War II was created, and this is the same year the United Nations was created. What's to this China lobby, Jonathan?
The China lobby is certainly not unique. We've seen in recent years a slew of foreign governments paying millions, in some cases tens of millions of dollars, to U.S. lobbying firms to get favorable treatment with regard to U.S. aid, human rights issues, arms sales, and the like. And you have giant wars battling between these lobbying groups. Former President Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was one of the kings of this lobbying group. He specialized in representing foreign governments that were widely hated because of domestic human rights violations and other crimes. But governments like that would pay good money, and Manafort always had his hand out for their money and did very well off it. Mm-hmm. Then began, of course, promoting clients in Ukraine. The China lobby was one of the first big ones that got notoriety, and it started actually in the late 1930s, what many people considered a good cause, when China was reeling under attack from Imperial Japan and began reaching out to the Roosevelt administration for aid. And then after 1945, when Japan was defeated, the communist opposition began growing in China. And so further aid went to the nationalist, again, anti-communist Chinese government after 1945 to bolster it. But much of the money that the U.S. was giving was disappearing, and the Treasury Department was rather concerned that U.S. gold and silver and so on were just disappearing into the claws of this corrupt government. And as I mentioned, in 1949, the communists finally achieved victory, and the rump government of nationalist China fled to Taiwan, sometimes in those days called Formosa, and was for many years recognized by the United States as the legitimate government of China, which, whatever your politics, was a little bit crazy, because generally we recognize countries on the basis of reality, not wishful thinking. And clearly the great bulk of China was now represented by the People's Republic of China, the communist government. But the China lobby was a group of Chinese nationalist officials, they're paid lobbyists, some American business people, some missionaries, and people involved in international trade, all of whom had an interest. In many cases, it was a very legitimate ideological interest in seeing anti-communist forces emerge victorious. But as I mentioned, there was this corrupt element where U.S. aid was siphoned back into this country to promote propaganda, to go into the pockets of certain politicians, and even a very serious allegation that I think is highly credible, that some of these nationalist Chinese were involved in the narcotics traffic and financing their political activities that way. One last thing. Their kind of biggest imprint was in an organization which I may get the name slightly wrong, the Committee of 1 Million to Prevent the Admission of Communist China to the United Nations. And they were the ones who basically held up U.S. recognition of Red China until the Nixon era. And so it was a very successful group. And they were the ones who also helped manage the ouster of many experts on the Far East from the State Department in the 1950s during the McCarthy era, which left the U.S. without a lot of expertise in this area and left certain politicians traumatized, again, about the fear of losing other countries to communism.
Jonathan, in your view, I step back and when I discuss this on a very elementary level with people, I look at the Chinese and I look at communism having been adopted by the Chinese and even Russia to a large extent. Yet I say, what was this influence to these major global powers that caused them to consider or at least end up adapting these political structures? The concept of communism certainly doesn't originate from China, nor does it originate from Russia. It's certainly kind of the philosophical approach to governance through people like Marx. Why is it, in your understanding, Jonathan, why is it that the Chinese adopted this form of government?
Well, first let me say I'm not at all an expert, so you'll get an educated lay view. Certain ideologies come and go in faddishness. One can think in the Arab world, for example, how there was, first nationalism, then Marxism, and then Islamism. as prevailing ideologies, which stripped to their core, if you want to be a cynic, you could say each of these at heart was a road to power, and the trappings of the ideology were less important than reflecting people's grievances at powerlessness and searching desperately for a movement and an ideology that could help them win power. And communism having been so successful in Russia after 1917, by successful I mean, of course, holding on to power, not necessarily successful in making everyone's life better or so forth. But it was a very attractive ideology and concept to groups, dissatisfied groups in other countries around the world that were looking to a model, looking for a model that could overthrow the yoke of European colonialism, or what some people term neocolonialism, which is a sort of indirect power. So I think for the Chinese communist movement, which certainly deviated a lot from classic Marxism, which viewed revolution coming from urban working classes, not from sort of semi-illiterate peasantry. But the Chinese communists thought this is a road to power. And certainly they had legitimate grievances at the way China had been held down by Western powers, and it was, after centuries of being one of the greatest powers on earth, was now a poor and dissolute country. They were looking for a way of restoring centralized power to China. They didn't, of course, care a whit about democracy or human rights or anything like that. They wanted national greatness. And I think communism appealed to them for that reason.
I want to ask you why you begin with Truman, and perhaps why was that the benchmark in Dark Quadrant? Why did you begin with Harry Truman?
That's a good question, and it was more than just the alliteration of Truman to Trump. I really see the post World War II era as the era in which organized crime rose to national power in the United States. Prohibition in the 1920s to early 30s was the era in which organized crime really got its first major foothold in big cities. It certainly existed before then, but this is when organized crime really became a financial powerhouse, thanks to the hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars spent on illegal liquor in the U.S., thanks to prohibition. But it took time for those criminal syndicates to begin reaching out of their cities like Chicago and New York and other cities like that, and to start investing and building organizations outside of their cities. And as their reach grew outside of cities, they needed to expand their political reach as well, outside of local police forces and mayors. Because the key to what makes organized crime organized is not just their approach to crime, but their approach to politics and law enforcement. You can't really maintain a successful criminal group long term unless you keep law enforcement at bay. And you do that through legal contributions, under the table payoffs, blackmail. For example, if you know that the mayor loves to gamble on race war, or go to illegal gambling parlors, you can blackmail him. Or extortion and violent intimidation. Usually the kind of payoff model works best, because then you've got happy political clients who are happy to see you grow, particularly serving so-called victimless crimes like gambling and so forth. And it was really after World War II that organized crime syndicates in major cities had really had the time to start branching out. The Chicago mob started a big branch out into Southern California, for example. And New York and Chicago had moved into Florida at that time. It was also a time of enormous growth in the size of the federal government. As we know, between the New Deal and World War II, we had a revolution in federalism in this country, and the federal government grew enormously in size, and a whole group of new federal bureaucracies grew up, and all of these were potential sources of money if you could get your hands on them, and it really encouraged the growth of corruption, not all certainly by organized crime, but as the federal government became a bigger trough of money, it attracted criminals of all sorts, and organized crime, of course, is very successful at what it does. So World War II was really the key transition point. And so Truman is the first of the post-war presidents. And most importantly, Truman had gotten his political start in Kansas City with an organized political mob called the Pendergast Machine. It was both a political machine, but also had its claws into all of the rackets, the prohibition bootlegging, prostitution, narcotics, and other rackets like that. And so it had a fantastically corrupt police force. And Truman basically looked the other way while all this was going on, strongly supported the Pendergast Machine as he rose through the ranks to U.S. Senator, and then to vice president in 1944, and then got lucky as president. And some of his first acts in office were to pardon members of the Pendergast Machine who had been convicted of vote fraud and all sorts of other crimes. And all through his administration, he showed tremendous favoritism towards crooks in a way that just blew the mind of millions of Americans. And historians have a collective amnesia about this, but one of the major reasons the Democrats lost the 1952 election and why Eisenhower and Nixon and a slew of Republicans down ballot swept the election in 1952 was voter disgust at corruption in the Truman era. It was deep and very, very serious. And much of it was tied, as I show in my book, to organized crime.
Last week, we had the fortune of hosting a former U.S. representative from Ohio, Dennis Kucinich. And Dennis had his latest book, The Division of Light and Power, gets into his work bringing to light the corruption. And he talks about the mafia. He talks about criminal syndicates, organized crime in Cleveland, where he was elected the youngest mayor at the time. I'd have to go back and listen to the episode. He may have actually, as you're speaking about Harry Truman, he may have actually spoken about the corruption within the Truman camp and campaign. Where does it come from, Jonathan, this acceptability within this democracy that we have inherited and that we're they were fighting to, if you will, to keep honest. Where is it that we as a country have allowed this to breach our system? Is it post World War II really that it's gotten a stronghold of the government? And let me say this as you respond to that, because again, for listeners, the book is Dark Quadrant. We're speaking with Jonathan Marshall, Organized Crime, Big Business, and most importantly here, folks, the corruption of American democracy. And what Jonathan is talking about is the big money ruining not to put the words in your mouth, Jonathan. Rephrase if you need, ruining the democracy. So to simplify that question, I'm going to say this. Again, I'm going to step back, Jonathan, and I'll say, well, we've got a close to $30 trillion national debt. Why is it that we've allowed this type of corruption into our federal government, Jonathan?
That's a great question, and I will say this, it does go far beyond my book. corruption, of course, long predates the Truman era and, frankly, long predates the United States of America. So it's a problem that goes back into the earliest days of human history. Classics experts can, I'm sure, cite all sorts of examples from ancient Rome about this. So it has to do with, I'm sure, the inquisitiveness of human nature and the kind of egotistic response to trying to, build one's own power and fortune at the expense of others. An easy sense that the ends justify the means. And these human instincts and trends haven't changed all that much over the millennia, unfortunately. We do try through our system of laws and education to ameliorate them and channel our behavior in more productive and beneficial ways. But as we see every year, this is a tremendous challenge. And I think the power of human rationalization is great as well, where people on both sides of the political spectrum find reason to explain away the crimes committed by their leaders as, well, the other side is even worse. This is small potatoes compared to what the other guy is doing. So it's very easy to kind of maintain corruption. It's also historically been easy because sometimes the same politicians who are taking money on the side are doing enough good for their political constituents for those constituents to overlook them. That was the classic way that urban political machines in America grew up. Many of them were, for example, helpful to immigrants who were looking for work or looking for citizenship and so on. And those people would often be willing to give their votes to the machine in return for good political service. So, and then there would be reform movements that would come up to try to fight this. Thus, you always have this tension throughout U.S. history, and frankly, the history of most nations, between corruption and reform. And it's unfortunately a never-ending battle. What I do in this book is look at corruption through the lens of organized crime, which is definitely a subset. I'm not by any means claiming that I'm summing up the problem. It's that organized crime is a special threat precisely because it is so organized. It has the tools and the knowledge to take corruption to a higher level than most other people do. But, and this is a big but, one of the things I show in my book is we're not just talking about kind of crude mafia-type organizations that get caricatured in the movies. The successful organized crime groups partnered with sophisticated white-collar lawyers and financial advisors and so on to carry out their acts of corruption. And the real threat, I think, to this country is that those same intermediaries who know the legal loopholes and have secret influence, they are bought just as easily by billionaires as they are by organized crime groups. And so as I conclude in the end, even getting rid of organized crime won't get rid of the corruption of money in American politics, which remains somewhat unconstrained, the power of lobbying, including foreign lobbying in this country, the fact that dark money can roam through our political system without much trace, the fact that offshore bank accounts can still be used for tax evasion and money laundering. These are all problems that cry out for reform. And there are some efforts in Congress to make some reforms, but they seem to be stymied along with just about every other piece of legislation these days.
I'm going to ask you the same question, and it does back up for listeners prior to Truman. And this is simply based off of research that I've done in collaboration. Well, not collaboration, but based off of, again, this Anthony Sutton figurehead. And I think perhaps Peter has talked about this, and you may mention this in other books. But I asked this question to Representative Kucinich last week. What is your thought, Jonathan, on the Federal Reserve? Is that a just system, banking system that represents the people accurately and balanced?
I personally don't have a problem with the Federal Reserve. I don't claim to be an absolute expert, but I've had a modest degree of economics training, and perhaps I've been brainwashed, but I don't think less flexible systems like the gold standard have worked particularly well. And I think the Fed, particularly in recent years, has been imperfectly managed, but probably better managed than the alternative. And so I guess I would say I don't have a big problem with that.
You talked about Vietnam, and this is something that that I faced when I was at that age of saying, well, wait a second. No, Iraq and Afghanistan, these wars don't make sense to me. And that's primarily the reason that I didn't join the armed forces, because I didn't believe in these foreign wars. In your research, why is it, as you were speaking about Vietnam, why is it that Vietnam was fought?
Well, as always, we have a complex series of reasons. I actually published a book quite some years ago that touches on this, and it looked at the, it was called To Have and Have Not, Southeast Asian Raw Materials and the Origins of the Pacific War, 1940 to 41. And it argued that what really caused the war between Japan and the United States was Japan's decision, after many years of fighting in China, to start moving its troops south towards the European colonies in Southeast Asia, British Malaya and the Dutch East Indies, today Malaysia and Indonesia. And those happen to be the world's greatest sources of natural rubber and tin and tungsten, along with some other materials that were considered vital to the U.S. economy. Think about all of U.S. transportation basically was based on rubber tires. In those days, 1940, it was all based on natural rubber. We didn't really have a synthetic rubber industry. The whole food industry was based on canning, which required tin. And so I show how American planners were terrified at the thought that Japan might cut us off of those vital resources. And as a result, the Roosevelt administration took steps to force a confrontation with Japan, which led Japan to decide that a sneak attack at Pearl Harbor was probably the best way of dealing with that inevitable confrontation. So I think that one of the reasons we got into the Vietnam War early on, especially in the Truman years, was a continuation of our concern over its role as a gateway to Southeast Asia and to a very economically important region. What happened then in the Cold War is the U.S. started building up Japan as an anti-communist aircraft carrier, as our anchor against communist China. And we decided that Japan needed Southeast Asia as part of its trading zone to build up its economy. It was a kind of bizarre replay of Imperial Japan's own reasons for going into Southeast Asia. But over time, our interests and focus began to shift away from those economic motives towards the anti-communist motives, and in particular, that domestic political fear I alluded to earlier by Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and even Nixon about not wanting to lose a war against communism on their watch. And it's really notable when you look at how long the war in Afghanistan went on without any shred of purpose, any claim of importance to U.S. national security. Why? It's gone on so long because no president wanted to say, I lost Afghanistan, or more incredibly, to have their opponents say, you lost Afghanistan. And that just terrifies American politicians. So I think by the time, of the late 60s, that was clearly one of the primary motives. Obviously, in every war, there are interest groups, whether oil companies or defense contractors and others, that are also making out like bandits. They certainly contribute to the ongoing momentum of wars, but they're not necessarily the initial drivers.
Dark Quadrant is the book, and Jonathan, you've really tackled an incredible subject. And Trump, before Trump, it was this kind of this deep state. This is something that he got, I think, Americans looking into the deep state, which I equate to this organized crime that you're bringing to light through your book. The work that you've done sounds fascinating, and I'd like to. As we wind down here, I'd like you to whet the appetite for listeners in regards to purchasing your book, and then segue into what you feel Americans need to be doing today to unify and strengthen that democracy that is becoming corrupted.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. We've talked a good deal about Truman, and as I mentioned, Truman actually lost a key primary. He was actually running for re-election in 1950 and lost in part because of his record of corruption. I show how Lyndon Johnson nearly got ousted from the 1964 ticket before President Kennedy's assassination because of his involvement in a major organized crime-related scandal involving his former aide, Bobby Baker. I show how Kennedy and Johnson were implicated with a leader of the Chicago mob who took control of America's biggest defense contractor, General Dynamics, at a time when it won the single biggest defense contract in U.S. history up to that time for the TFX fighter plane. So a huge potential scandal that was squelched because of the assassination of President Kennedy. I don't claim that Kennedy was killed because of that, but that was one of the big effects. And we've seen, of course, how President Nixon was forced to resign because of Watergate, and I have a lengthy chapter showing how his resignation in Watergate actually stemmed from a series of political forces going back to 1960, when the CIA teamed up with organized crime to try to assassinate Castro, unleashing a whole series of subterranean blackmail campaigns by organized crime figures and their lawyers and representatives in Washington, culminating in Watergate. So anyone with an interest in modern American history, I think, should rush out and get this. In addition, then I trace the lineage of all of these powers through the Reagan and ultimately to the Trump presidency. And much as Donald Trump decried the deep state, I have to say his record doesn't look too great either. He was almost openly boasted about his connections with New York mafia bosses when he was building some of his biggest projects in Manhattan. Yeah. And in Atlantic City. And later, much of the funding of his business empire seemed to fall towards foreign oligarchs, some of whom are suspected of connections to East European and even Russian mafia. So that's a disturbing story I tell there as well. I think I trace the role of some of these billionaire oligarchs and point out that even if American organized crime were destroyed completely, you would still have two problems. One, you now have international criminal gangs, Chinese triads, Japanese yakuza, Russian mafia, Latin drug cartels that are powerful. But you also have legitimate billionaires who now exercise outside influence over American politics in both parties.
Yeah.
And their billions can sway political decisions. We certainly saw this with Sheldon Adelson's influence over Donald Trump's Middle Eastern policies. And I think that we need desperately reform to end the power of dark money, to create more transparency about money in politics. We need to end the way in which, for example, many of Donald Trump's real estate transactions were done with shell companies. No one has any idea whether the shell was representing a perfectly legitimate businessman or a front man for the Russian mafia. And that's not to say Trump was guilty of anything selling to those shell companies, but to limit money laundering and the political power that can come from it, we need greater transparency in our transactions as well. And frankly, I know people have different opinions. Many people don't hate the IRS, but we have the IRS is essentially no longer audits billionaires at all. And I think that's not a successful way to run a modern government or a clean government. And we need at least a restoration of balance here, where we are highly attuned to the dangers of government power overstepping, while at the same time being aware that private power can overstep as well. And we need a healthy balance if we're to maintain a cleaner government.
Fascinating, Jonathan. There's an early guest of mine that I believe teaches at the University of Wisconsin, but during his PhD thesis work, the manuscripts that he had written, which later turned into a later book called "The Politics of Heroin: CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade," Al McCoy, he had actually made a trip to the Far East. And when he returned to New Haven, he got a knock on his door from the CIA demanding that that the manuscripts be turned over. And he says, "No, this is my research." So he took him to court and he won. So if you're not familiar with that story, that might be intriguing to you. And I commend you on the incredible work that you're doing, sir. What's next for you? And where can listeners find his publication?
Well, first of all, Al McCoy is a great scholar, and I've known him for some years, and he's in my footnotes, so
fantastic.
I certainly appreciate his work. And indeed, in my book, I make some further advances on his work, and based on some new archival discoveries I made, which were quite exciting. So, and my book can be found in independent bookstores, and certainly from online booksellers, including but not limited to Amazon. And I encourage people to dip into it. I think they'll find a lot of fascinating and untold stories there. It's a book, I might add, because it's easy to make sensational claims. One of the problems is anyone can do it these days. My book is a little different in that it's got something like 150 pages of footnotes and citations to the National Archives, multiple presidential libraries, FBI records, CIA records. It's all laid out there in detail. You don't have to read the footnotes, but knowing that they're there, I think, will help support that what you're reading is real history and not just another person, blowhard's claims about the mysterious secrets of our universe. This is real stuff, and I think that makes it stand out as well.
Wow, phenomenal. Ladies and gentlemen, author Jonathan Marshall, the book is Dark Quadrant, Organized Crime, Big Business, The Corruption of American Democracy from Truman to Trump. Jonathan, thank you for taking the time, and thanks again for standing by and waiting. I look forward to being in touch with you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Jonathan Marshall, and look, it's of course I didn't realize that that he'd known and knows Al McCoy. That's fantastic. Al was one of the early guests on my show back in 2017. A phenomenal scholar, and also Peter Dale. Well, that was my. That was my syndicate there in Scotland, my connection in Scotland, and I had forgotten to thread them in, so I'll send them this recording. I apologize, Peter Dale Scott, is in the name that I have been familiar with as well. So Jonathan Marshall, folks, look, if you have not had a chance, look into this reporter, Ivory Hecker, who blew the whistle on her being censored in Fox Houston. She did it just a couple of days ago with Project Veritas with James O'Keefe. The background on this is I personally met Ivory in the Breakers Hotel, her and her boyfriend. This is Palm Beach in December. And she had notified me of what she had intended to do. And she had said that she had been in touch with Murdoch Jr., and he was aware that she was being censored and that she would be blowing the whistle to some degree. Maybe not verbatim did he know that, but he definitely knew that something was up. They made no measures to accommodate her research, similar to many of you that are being censored, whether on the internet or by your schools. Folks, freedom of press, freedom of speech, that should apply to all industries and all outlets, regardless of size or measure. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back. I should be back Saturday with the great guests, but I will be back until next soon. Until next time, folks, be awesome.